Hey everyone, Aaron here. Clem and Chet, your Murder Tonic hosts, graciously agreed to let me kick off their new episode with a quick pitch. We've got big plans for creative license this year, and while we're more than ready to jump in and do the work to make it happen, we need your help. We hope you consider joining our Patreon. There are levels to fit any budget and a variety of fun perks. But most importantly, your support allows us to put more money in the pockets of the artists that share their time and talent with us, and all of you. To find out more, visit our website at www.creativelicenseonline.com and click the Patreon link. And now, on with the episode.
There's nothing better than a fresh start, a change of scenery, an opportunity to leave the past in your rearview mirror and reinvent yourself. Such was the case for Sidney Prescott, a fierce survivor of one of the most gruesome, brutal killing sprees in recent memory. Hopeful to leave the trauma of the last 2 years behind her, Sidney traveled nearly 3,000 miles across the country to Ohio in search of her fresh start as a student at Windsor College. She made new friends, found new love, landed the starring role in the school play. But with the release of a new horror film inspired by her story came a new string of murders, eerily familiar and too close to home. And suddenly, Sydney's fresh start turned into a new nightmare. I'm Clementine McDougal.
And I'm Chesterfield Huxley.
And this is Murder Tonic, the Windsor College Murders.
Hello, my darling Clem.
Chesterfield, hello there. It's great to be back in the booth with you covering the second installment of this twisted, heartbreaking case.
It really is. Of course, we all hoped Sidney Prescott had reached the light at the end of a very dark tunnel, but sadly, the horror and trauma of Woodsboro followed her across the country. But before we get into this week's case, we have a new addition to the booth today.
We do, and I am stoked.
We're excited to share with all of you that the Murder Tonic team has expanded, and we want to extend a huge welcome to our new technical director, Silas Campbell.
Hey, everyone. Happy to be here.
Silas, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I recently received my master's in criminology from Georgetown University. While studying there, I interned with NPR, where I had the chance to interview the son of
Silas. Oh my God, you're like a true crime expert.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I was part of the team that cracked the infamous case of...
I'm so sorry. I just have to ask you really quick. Will you have a cocktail with us? It's not a Murder Tonic recording without one.
Sure.
I'll mix you one. My dirty martinis are famously filthy. Like, you're going to need a tetanus shot.
Chesterfield, maybe we should start out slow. We don't want to have too many drinks and get messy for the recording. I'm just joking. Obs, make me one too and make it a double, please.
Well, it's actually...
Silas, I know it's your first time with us, but you have nothing to be nervous about.
We'll take very good care of you. We promise.
Wait.
So, everyone, grab your cocktails and settle in. This is the Windsor College Murders. After Billy Loomis and Stu Mocker died, everyone hoped this case would come to a close and the survivors could move on with their lives. But the world of pop culture had other plans.
Our favorite badass bitch, Gail Weathers, released her book, The Woodsboro Murders, a mere months before the killings. And shortly after that came Stab, the new film starring Tori Spelling and Luke Wilson that brought the terrible string of murders to the big screen.
Clem, tell me, what did you think of the book and the movie?
Well, I wouldn't dare speak ill of anything Gail, our queen, had a hand in. So of course I love the book. I devoured it in one night. The movie, though,
was pretty terrible.
I know.
First and foremost, the opening scene with Heather Graham.
Oh, I love her.
I know, honey. We all do. Who hasn't secretly wished they were Roller Girl opposite a prosthetically enhanced Marky Mark? But here's what I want to know. It opens on a phone call with Casey and the killer. How did the creators of the movie know what they were talking about on the phone? Everyone who was involved in that original phone call is deceased.
Well, we know that the killer asked Sydney what her favorite scary movie was, so maybe they just used that Sydney conversation and then made up the rest.
I guess. It just seems flimsy to me.
You guys know that when they make a movie about real life, they take a lot of liberties. They leave stuff out, they add stuff, sometimes they make up characters. You guys know it's not real, right?
You know, Cy, you have a really great voice. Have you ever considered hosting a podcast?
I think we have all the voice talent we need, Clem. Silas, more clicky-clacky, less talky-talky. We were talking about the casting of Steph.
And Tori Spelling as Sydney, Luke Wilson as Billy. Who cast this movie? You have Heather Graham and you kill her off in the first 10 minutes? Dumb.
If there was a movie about your life, Clem, who would you want cast to play you?
Oh, easy. Christina Hendricks.
Ooh, good one. What about you, Silas?
Oh, I don't know. Edward Norton, maybe?
Oh, my God. No way. It should be someone much more handsome than Edward Norton. Don't sell yourself short, Cy. I'd say a sexy cross between Armie Hammer and James Franco.
Clem, are you still seeing Gary?
Who?
Gary, the cop with the cute white dog. Aren't you guys still together?
Yeah. Why?
Just asking. Well, it's safe to say that Stab reignited the interest in this case and served as a catalyst to this vicious second chapter that ultimately led to the deaths of six, including our two new killers, Mickey Altieri and Nancy Loomis, a.k.a. Debbie Salt. And while Nancy's story actually started with the death of her son, Billy, we're going to start with the opening night of Stab, where this fresh set of killings began with the untimely death of Maureen Evans and Phil Stevens.
Absolutely, Chet. Now, we know that Maureen and Phil attended Windsor College with Sydney and that they caught the 9:50 p.m. movie on opening night. We spoke to Phil's roommate, who told us that Phil received the movie tickets for free that night, but he didn't know who Phil got them from. And while this has never been confirmed, I do wonder...
I know exactly where you're going with this, Clem.
Did Mickey give Phil the tickets?
I mean, he must have, right? We know that Maureen and Phil were targeted not only because they attended the same school as Sydney and Mickey, but because of the similarities in their names with the victims back in Woodsboro. Sydney's mother, Maureen Prescott, who was killed by Billy and Stu, and Stephen Orth, who was murdered at the Becker house along with Casey. So, that being said, if Mickey didn't orchestrate their attendance at the movie that night, that's a hell of a coincidence.
Exactly.
So here's what we know regarding the timeline of that night at the movie theater. Like we mentioned, the movie started at 9:50. And the crowds were insane that night. It was a packed house, and every staff member of the theater was called into work. And a key piece of information to know is that the theater gave away ghost face costumes to everyone in attendance.
Okay, I have to say, this was a real, true story. People died, and the studio is giving out costumes like it's a goddamn party. It's pretty tasteless, if you ask me.
So, that wasn't you next to me eagerly snatching a costume out of the usher's hands when you and I went to see Stab on opening night?
Oh, no, that was me. It's an amazing costume. But still, it's offensive, you know?
Anyway, these costumes were in everyone's hands, which explains why the killers were able to move about the theater and commit these murders under the radar. That and the absolute mayhem that was going on while the movie was playing, the theater literally rigged up ghost face dummies from the ceiling and flew them across the room. It's insane.
It really is. So about 10 minutes into the movie, Maureen and Phil were seen talking in the lobby outside of the theater. They finished their conversation. Maureen goes back into the theater and Phil goes into the restroom. Nobody knows what exactly happened in that restroom, but shortly after Phil was seen entering, another moviegoer found his body lying dead on the floor. His jacket had been removed and he had been stabbed through the ear from the neighboring stall.
Was it ever determined what happened to his jacket?
No, not conclusively. It could have been taken as a token, but that kind of behavior isn't really consistent with the other killings. The prevailing theory is that the killer removed his jacket, put it on, and re-entered the theater in an attempt to fool Maureen into thinking it was Phil beside her. But since nobody could attest to seeing Maureen get stabbed, there's no proof of that.
Yes, that right there was the key, Clem. Nobody saw anything happen to Maureen. One minute, everyone is enjoying the movie, and the next, Maureen is standing on the stage in front of the crowd, blood dripping from her mouth, and seven stab wounds in her body.
How in the hell did nobody see a woman get stabbed seven times in a packed theater?
Well, it was chaos in that theater. Clem, over 200 people hooting and hollering in identical ghost face costumes, running up and down the aisles. It makes sense.
Okay. Regardless of what anyone did or didn't see, two innocent people were killed that night in the theater. Not a single clue or piece of evidence was found, and their deaths were the catalyst for what would befall Sydney Prescott and her circle of friends over the next 2 days.
The next morning brings an absolute circus to the Windsor College campus. News vans, reporters, curious onlookers, the whole nine yards.
Sydney and her friends, Randy from Woodsboro.
Oh my God, Randy. Can I talk about him for a hot second, please?
Yes, Chesterfield, of course.
Okay, so we didn't talk much about Randy in our Woodsboro Murders episode, but I feel like now is the time. When we were working on our Woodsboro Murders report, we heard from many sources that it was widely understood that Randy had a thing for Sydney. But as far as we know, Sydney never reciprocated that feeling. So all of the shit goes down, right? People die, etc., etc. Sydney makes a clean break and moves 3,000 miles away for college. And Randy follows her? And that doesn't raise red flags for anyone?
Maybe it was like a safety in numbers thing, or like a security blanket, having someone by your side who knows what you went through.
I don't know. I'm skeptical.
Excuse me, Chesterfield, but how did you end up attending Harvard again?
Don't you dare.
Oh, I'm daring. What was his name? He was tall, or he always wore a bow tie, and he had that gross ponytail like that Nexium guy.
His name was Anthony, and he was beautiful, and you never appreciated his soulful spirit.
He was so weird, and you followed him to Boston like he was an angel sent from above.
No, he was no angel. Although he did have a set of wings tattooed along the side of his angelic...
Then he turned your entire dorm room into a cult. I remember the weeks of deprogramming, Chesterfield. Anyway, now that we got that out of the way, we've got Sydney, Randy, Hallie McDaniel, Sydney's roommate, Derek Feldman, Sydney's boyfriend, and Mickey, who we now know was the killer. They're all in the square watching the press conference led by Police Chief Lewis Hartley, and just like that, it turns into a Woodsboro reunion. Dewey shows up, presumably to check on Sydney, and our girl Gail shows up with Cotton fucking Weary in tow.
Gail is wild and I love it. She really chose this moment to orchestrate a surprise interview between Sydney and Cotton. She's a stone cold Steve Austin of journalism, and I don't care who knows it. I can't even. I need a refill.
Ooh, top me off, Chetty.
It's just... Cotton had already been doing the media circuit, appearing on Current Edition and lots of other second-rate shows. But to bring him to Ohio to talk to Sydney, who hasn't seen him in person since the trial of her mother's murder, is just on a whole other level.
It truly was. Needless to say, the reunion did not go well. Sydney was seen slapping Gail across the face again, and then the crowd broke up.
At that point, Gail was seen being swarmed by reporters, and footage obtained by one of the local news affiliates shows her conversing with Nancy Lewis, who was posing as Debbie Salt, a reporter from the Post-Telegraph. Wise choice of cover, I'd say. Hiding in plain sight.
Absolutely. Gail gave a statement after the series of events at Windsor College, and she said that Nancy, or Debbie, had told her she attended Gail's seminar in Chicago last year, and that in the course of these few days, every time Gail turned around, Nancy was there. Was she targeting Gail?
Well, we'll never know, but it absolutely seems likely. After all, Gail was the one that pulled the trigger and fired the bullet that killed Billy Loomis back in Woodsboro. And you know all the negative shit she said about Billy in her book. It also adds some context to the phone call that came into Gail's cell phone the following day that ended up leaving Randy Meeks dead.
You're so right, Chet. And we'll get to Randy shortly. So later that night, after the chaos of the press conference died down, where do you think Sydney and her friends find themselves?
Safe at home in their dorms?
You would think, but no. A sorority party at the Delta Lambda Zeta house.
Of course. These kids love going to parties while ruthless murderers are on the loose.
And across campus at the neighboring Omega Beta Zeta house, Ghostface is about to claim his or her next victim.
Inside the Omega Beta Zeta house, Windsor student CC Cooper is home alone, acting as a sober sister in case one of her housemates needs a ride home. Now, we don't know much about what transpired with CC, but here's what we do know. Her roommate Donna stopped by the house to pick something up, and while she was only there a few minutes, she reported that CC was alive and well and on the phone with her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Ted.
Now, Chet, was that confirmed?
No. Authorities tracked down Ted as a possible suspect after CC's body was found, and his claims, which were backed up by several of his friends, made it obvious that he could not have called CC that night.
So it must have been the killer. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It sure does, Clem. Casey Becker was on the phone with her killer right before she died back in Woodsboro. And it's no coincidence that CeCe's real name was actually Casey.
And while we don't exactly know what transpired on that phone call, what we do know is pretty horrific. When authorities came to the Omega Beta Zeta house, they discovered several pieces of broken furniture on the first floor of the house, a smashed flower pot on the landing, and a bicycle wedged into the second floor staircase. The attic window was smashed, and traces of blood were found on the floor of the attic balcony. CC was stabbed twice in the middle of her back, then thrown over the balcony railing, landing on the ground below, dying almost instantly.
Back at the Delta Lambda Zeta house, everyone is filing out of the party to check out the commotion at Omega Beta Zeta. And according to police statements from Sydney and others, it seems like that's exactly what the killers wanted. Here's the picture the reports paint. The house's landline rings, and for some strange reason, Sydney answers it. And surprise, it's the killer.
Oh my God, Chet, why do you still have that thing? I told you to burn it or bury it. Just don't use it around me.
Think about it, Clem. You gotta give Billy and Stu credit. The only reason Mickey and Nancy were able to take this as far as they did is because of the brilliance of using this disguise. They made it so anyone can slip on that mask and change their voice and become Ghostface. Anybody could do it.
Silas, what's your favorite skill?
Clem's right. Hand it over.
Thank you, Cy. Now, where were we? Let's go. It's almost drink time.
Right. So, just like in Woodsboro, Sydney and the killer have an exchange over the phone, and then Sydney is attacked. She's chased through the house, knocking over furniture, and meets Derek and Dewey around the back. Derek goes back into the house in search of the killer, but gets stabbed in the arm in the process.
There also seemed to be a lot of drama at the hospital in the aftermath of these attacks. We spoke to a Windsor police officer who wished to remain anonymous, and he told us that the consensus among the chief and other officers was that Derek's story was a bit shaky. Nobody could understand why he would enter that house knowing the killer was inside. Then Derek apparently turned it all around on Dewey, calling his presence there a red flag.
So clearly there was a lot of confusion and frustration surrounding solving this case.
Totally. Ugh, what do we think, Chetty? Refill break?
You read my mind. We'll be right back.
We're back. We've refreshed our drinks, and we're ready to take this baby home. Sai, what are your thoughts so far on this case?
Well, it's interesting.
Sai, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I've been meaning to ask you this all day. What's your sign?
Capricorn?
Of course you are. I'm an Aries, so we are very compatible.
Really, Chet?
What?
Everybody knows Aries and Capricorns are notoriously incompatible.
That's not true.
Chet, I majored in astrological sciences for a semester, okay? I think I would know.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You changed your major like 7 times while we were in school together. It's just difficult keeping track sometimes.
Wow.
Guys, let's try to...
Silas, you're right, as usual. This is not the way we want to conduct ourselves in this podcast. I love you, Chesterfield. You know that. And I'm sorry, big homo.
I know. I love you too, you wretched battle axe. And I'm sorry. Let's get back on track.
Yikes.
Okay, we're in the final stretch of this nightmare weekend at Windsor College. And for some strange fucking reason, Sydney, in the midst of being stalked by a killer or killers, goes to her tech rehearsal for her play.
Yeah, I can't wrap my mind around that either. In what world is this play still opening with all of these bodies piling up around campus? Imagine being stalked and tormented and having your classmates die around you, and you wake up the next morning and go, you know, I think I'll go rehearse a play in which I play a Greek princess who is cursed by a spurned suitor to see the future and make prophecies that nobody will ever believe to be true. Irony much?
Wow. Well said, my friend.
Thank you. Sorry. Ignorance of the relevance of Greek mythology in our everyday lives is a real bugaboo of mine.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. And can I add, look, I love Sydney, but when I found out she was studying acting, I kind of lost respect. I mean, this is your post-trauma plan? Maybe try keeping a low profile, Sid.
Somebody's sore about the actor who dumped her senior year.
Ew, anyway, we've reached the point in our story where poor Randy checks into the horizontal Hilton.
The motel 6 feet under, if you will.
Randy, Gail, and Dewey are sitting in the campus square, probably getting some sun on the quad, figuring out their next moves when Gail's cell phone rings. It's the killer, and they can see the trio. Somehow, Randy ends up with the phone while Gail and Dewey rush around the square trying to find the caller. Details are unclear as to how Randy found himself in Gail's news van, but what we do know is that Randy's lifeless body was discovered inside the van, stabbed 4 times. And one big question that comes up surrounding Randy's death, as we briefly mentioned earlier, is regarding that phone call. The call came into Gail's phone, and we know from Gail's testimony that Nancy admitted to being the one to kill Randy. So given what we've talked about, I mean, isn't it safe to say that Nancy was targeting Gail and Randy just got caught in the crosshairs?
Absolutely, Clem. Gail's lucky to be alive.
So amidst all of this, the local police have assigned 2 detectives, Richards and Andrews, to guard Sydney. They follow her around campus, you know, the dining hall, the library, with their eyes peeled for Ghostface. While in the library, Sydney, working at the shared computers, is cyber attacked by someone. Though it was never proven if this was one of the killers or just a random college kid stirring up trouble. In any case, Sydney goes to leave the library and bumps into Cotton fucking Weary.
Okay, can I just ask a question?
Please.
What the hell is Cotton doing? Seriously, he's not a college student. He doesn't live in Ohio. Gail brought him out to do an interview with Sydney, which she vehemently refused to do. So what is he doing skulking around this campus? Take a hint, dude. Stop being creepy and go home.
You are not wrong, Chet. And he continues to pop up throughout the rest of this day around campus. If I were Sydney or one of the others wrapped up in this mess, I would have definitely been suspicious of him. And, side note, the whole country was dying to talk to Sydney about what happened in Woodsboro. But she notoriously turned down big-time media outlets like Primetime Live, 2020, Dateline. I mean, why would Gail and Cotton think she would feel any differently about this interview?
Right? I mean, he's grabbing Sydney's arm, yelling in her face, to what end? You need to go home and go to bed, sir. I mean, this campus seriously needs to be under lockdown.
So, with Sydney back at the police station and with news about Randy's death, the chief decides to move Sydney to a safe location, along with Officer Richards and Andrews and Sydney's roommate, Hallie. Sydney packs up her shit, says goodbye to her boyfriend Derek, and the four hit the road. In the meantime, Gooey and Dale... No. Wait. Dewey and Gail, determined to figure out who's behind this, find themselves back on campus at the college's arts building with crowd footage in tow.
That's a tricky one for you, isn't it?
It is.
According to their testimonies, one of the killers follows them into the building. A fight ensues, and Dewey is stabbed in the back.
Okay, I have to say, how the fuck does Dewey survive this? Crime scene photos show massive amounts of blood in that recording studio. On the floor, face height against the window, which leads us to assume blood was sputtering out of his mouth before he fell to the ground. And this attack happened in the evening, but Dewey isn't rescued by paramedics until sunrise. How long is he laying on this floor, bleeding out? Is he superhuman or something?
And, speaking of shit that doesn't make sense, we have yet another party going on tonight. This time being thrown by the Omega Kappa Betas on stage at the Art Center where Sydney was rehearsing her play just hours before. Derek, Sydney's boyfriend, is tied up to one of the set pieces as punishment for giving Sydney his Greek letters. Look, I'm all for a party, but in this situation with multiple people being murdered daily, Chesterfield's getting the fuck out of touch.
Yeah, things are going off the rails fast around here. While Dewey's getting hacked up and Derek's getting beer poured down his boxers.
College, am I right, Zach?
Focus, Chet. Sydney's car ride to safety is not going well. Ghostface intervenes, leaving Officer Richards, Officer Andrews, and Hallie dead in and around the car just outside of town. Sydney, able to flee from the scene, inexplicably retreats to the theater on campus.
Ugh, theater kids. It's my safe space. Fucking clueless.
Where she finds Derek still strung up on the set piece. She's in the process of trying to untie him when she's confronted by the killers, Nancy and Mickey, with hostage Gail in tow. And sadly, Derek is shot and killed by Mickey before Sydney can get him down.
Rest in peace, Derek, the ultimate hero of this story. Total dreamboat, took care of Sydney, sang her love songs in the dining hall, died in his boxers. A true icon.
Amen.
Witness reports state that Nancy was the principal orchestrator of the murders. She was out for revenge for not only the death of her son, Billy, but for Maureen, Sydney's mother, having an affair with her husband, Hank, that essentially led to the crumbling of her family. But she realized she couldn't do it alone, and that once everything unraveled, She would need a fall guy.
Enter Mickey Altieri.
Exactly. Apparently, Nancy found Mickey online on some dark web serial killer chat room.
That I have definitely never visited.
And they teamed up to target Sydney and everyone around her.
The records of Mickey and Nancy's online conversations are sealed, so unfortunately we don't know when exactly they started talking or what those conversations entailed. But you have to wonder, did Nancy send Mickey to Windsor, paying his tuition in order to get to Sydney, or did Nancy just get incredibly lucky finding a wannabe serial killer who happened to go to the same school as Sydney?
She had to have sent him there. It would be way too big of a coincidence, right?
I think so, too.
So Nancy's plan was to let Mickey be his crazy-ass self, leaning into his plan of getting caught, blaming the movies, and becoming a tabloid sensation. Then, once the murders were completed, Nancy would shoot Mickey and everyone else and frame him as the only killer. She'd disappear into the night, and that would be that.
Keep dreaming, Nancy. When Gail and Sydney are around, vicious psychopaths don't stand a chance.
So, as planned, Nancy shoots Mickey, but not before Mickey shoots Gail in the side, hurtling her into the orchestra pit.
Oh, Mickey. You were a patsy, but you had great hair. We should do an episode about serial killers with bangs.
And when Nancy turns her gun on Sydney, things don't go exactly as she planned. Sydney is a fighter, and she turned that theatrical set upside down in order to defend herself from Nancy. Police found bullet holes all over the set, and all of the ropes for the building's fly system were cut. The set for the play, a series of towers built by faux rocks, was completely broken down, and broken stage lights and sandbags were everywhere. And just when it looked like Sydney might meet her end at the hands of Nancy, in comes
Cotton Fucking Weary.
Cotton Fucking Weary, y'all. Everyone's favorite creep found his way to the theater where he was able to shoot Nancy, saving Sydney and Gail, who survived her gunshot.
That's proof, Cy, that sometimes you should trust your stalker.
And apparently, after all of this, in a last scare plucked right out of the movies, Mickey jumped to his feet, but was swiftly shot down again by Sydney and Gail by nearly a dozen bullets.
My girls, kicking ass and killing bad guys. I love to see it.
And there you have it, Clem. The Windsor College Murders.
That was a wild ride, Chetty. I truly hope that Sydney and... Okay, wait, I got this. Gail and Dewey...
Good job, buddy.
...will be able to find some peace. But you know if they don't, we'll be back.
Silas, any final thoughts?
Yes. Do you guys have an HR department?
Clem, thank you for joining me on this true crime adventure today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, my dear. And a big thank you to all of our listeners. I'm Clementine McDougal.
And I'm Chesterfield Huxley.
And I'm quitting.
May your men be hot.
Your cocktails be cold.
And your true crime obsession never die. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
This has been Murder Tonic, a What the Hell Are We Doing Here production. If you know a crime story you think we should cover on an upcoming episode, or you just want to tell us how great we are, click the link in the show notes.